Save big on everything for your next staining project when you shop at Menards. Transform your home in one weekend with exterior stain and sealer from Dutch Boy. It provides one coat protection on decks, fences, siding, and outdoor furniture, and repels rain after just 4 hours of application. That means quicker results, saving you both time and money. Check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for more great deals happening this week. Save big money at Menards. Open the door to huge savings now at Menards. Enhance the appearance of your home with a new stylish garage door. Choose from our large in-stock selection of ideal garage doors or design your own using our free garage door designer. In-store or on Menards.com. Save big on ideal garage doors. And don't forget to check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now. Save big money
at Menards. Hey guys, and welcome to Mysteries and Histories with me, your host, Georgia Marie. This podcast is adapted from my YouTube channel, and this episode is part of my Vault series, where I'm turning my back catalogue into podcasts. So, if I ever reference photos or things on screen, please remember that these episodes were originally made for video. Also, if research or references seem out of date, please bear in mind as well that some of these episodes were recorded as far back as 2016. I just want to make sure that all of my content is available on podcast as well for you to enjoy. If you wish to find me on YouTube, I am just Georgia Marie over there, and with all my disclaimers out of the way, enjoy the episode. This month, we're covering the case of Andrew Cunanan. I'm going to say Andrew Cunanan. Some different documentaries and news reports pronounced it Cunanan or Cunanan. So I recently watched American Crime Stories, The Assassination of Gianni Versace, and that show is absolutely incredible. Anything Ryan Murphy does is always amazing. And it's inspired me to cover Andrew Cunanan for this week's or this month's serial killer spotlight video. He was a killer that I had heard of before. I'd sort of like looked into a little bit, but hadn't really fully gone headfirst in there. So this month, after watching The Assassination of Gianni Versace, I decided that it was probably time that I learnt a little bit more about him. And by watching this video, I'm going to impart my wisdom on you. The story of his crimes and the psychology behind his crimes is particularly interesting in this one. So as the title of American Crime Story may have told you, Andrew Cunanan would go on to kill Gianni Versace. And had he not done this, I don't really think he would be that well known as a serial killer, really. He'd probably just be one of those random obscure ones that you just read like in the back of a book. And there is actually a little bit of controversy over Andrew being referred to as a serial killer. Some say he's actually a spree killer instead. Serial killer is defined as like clearly separate murders. None of the people have any connection to each other. They're just random serial killings. A spree killer is a little bit different. A spree killer is a person who commits two or more murders without a cooling off period, like in between. So basically all of the murders happen in really quick succession, and Andrew killed 5 people in the space of 4 months. So you can decide what you think he is, a serial killer, a spree killer, maybe both. I suppose it doesn't really matter. He's still just a pretty shitty guy either way. So Andrew Cunanan was born on August 31st, 1969 in San Diego, California, to his parents Modesto Cunanan, who is also known as Pete. He was a Filipino-American, and Marianne Cunanan, or I think her maiden name was Scalacci. She was an Italian-American. Now, Andrew was actually the youngest of 4 children. He had 3 older siblings, Regina, Elena, and Christopher, and they were all raised in a very Catholic household. Marianne was a devout Catholic. And from the day he was born, Andrew was the clear favourite. Like, there's no denying it, Andrew was definitely the favourite child in this family. And he was particularly the favourite child of his dad. Now, around the time that Andrew was born, Marianne actually started to suffer really badly with postnatal depression, and she actually had to be hospitalised for this. And Modesto, who's actually serving in the US Navy in Vietnam at the time of Andrew, comes back from Vietnam and has to be sort of the sole person raising this baby. And through this, Modesto, like, kind of becomes, I suppose you could say, obsessed with his son. He thinks his son is literally the best person in the entire world, and that is no exaggeration. Generally, the youngest child always gets spoiled in a way that the older children don't. Like, that's just the way it usually is. But for Andrew, this was a whole nother level. I mean, Modesto thought that Andrew was so crazy good looking that he was just convinced that he was going to go really, really far in life. When the family moved to a new house, Andrew is the one to get the master bedroom, not Modesto and Marianne, Andrew gets the master bedroom with the attached ensuite. When he's 14 years old, so not even old enough to drive yet, Modesto buys him a sports car. And he is the only child of the four to be sent to this really expensive private school. It's the Bishop School in La Jolla. And I think everyone just kind of realised that was the way it was going to be in that household from now on. Andrew was the number one child. Andrew was going to be the one to get everything. And he did. His siblings referred to him as Prince Andrew. So like I said, Modesto was known as Pete to most people. I think Pete was like his American name. He was from the Philippines and he was actually working in the US Navy at the time that Andrew was born. But he actually eventually retires from the Navy and returns home. Now he works as a lab assistant whilst he's attending night school so he can train to be a stockbroker. And when Modesto finishes his course, he goes on to work at Merrill Lynch, which is like one of the top places to work if you want to be a stockbroker. And he earned pretty good money. And for Modesto, like, this was everything. He thought that being rich, being wealthy, was like all you needed in life. And so Modesto was pretty happy. He would buy the most expensive suits, most expensive shoes, most expensive cars. He was later quoted as saying, "Wherever there were rich people, that's where you would find me." For a while, he could genuinely afford this lavish lifestyle, but he would always like stress to Andrew how important it was to be perceived as wealthy. Even if you weren't, you had to be perceived as wealthy to get anywhere in life. And he told Andrew that, like, you don't actually have to be it, just pretend to be it, and you can do whatever you want. I mean, imagine being a child and having that mindset forced on you from the time that you're like a toddler, that you're the most important person in the world, that you can do literally anything you want to do. All that matters is to grow up and be successful, or at least be perceived as successful, even if you're not. And he was just completely, completely spoiled rotten. It would undoubtedly have an impact on your way of thinking. So Modesto spent a while at Merrill Lynch, but he talked the talk and didn't walk the walk. He wasn't actually very good at his job. He wasn't hitting any of his targets whatsoever. And so he's eventually let go. And he sort of bounces between all these different jobs in stockbroking over the next few years, but he never lasts more than 2 years at any company because he is just not good at it. He would tell everyone how amazing he was at his job, but he actually wasn't. He was fired from pretty much every one of them. And as he's sort of like bouncing between these trading companies, it's just getting smaller and smaller companies each time. And he is getting an increasing amount of debt because he's still living this lavish lifestyle without the money to actually back it up. And bear in mind as well that he's sending Andrew to one of the most prestigious private schools in the state. And so reportedly, Modesto turns to making tradie financial deals to combat his financial problems. So if you've watched the TV show The Assassination of Gianni Versace, you would have seen that in 1988 he was embezzling huge amounts of money, and the FBI literally show up at his place of work, follow him back to his home, and they're going to arrest him. But Modesto manages to escape and he actually runs back to the Philippines. There seems to be a little bit of debate on the internet as to the facts actually around this. It may have been slightly exaggerated in the show. Some sources say that it definitely did happen, and one of these sources is Modesto's wife, Marianne. But a Times article from 2001 says that San Diego police actually have no record of any charges ever being brought against Modesto Kinnanen. Marianne alleged that her husband had misappropriated over $100,000 from his stock brokerage firms, and she filed all these court documents to sort of like prove it. To be honest, he just fled back to the Philippines, he sold the family's two houses and the cars, and he gathered every single penny that he had and he just left for Manila, leaving the entire family with just $700. At this time, Andrew was 19 years old, and as you can imagine, he's attended this private school. He's been told all of his life that all that matters really is being wealthy and people knowing your name. And now he's literally left with nothing. And his father, who is his absolute idol, has gone off to the Philippines, not really saying a word. After this, Marianne literally had to live on food stamps and welfare for the rest of her life. But Marianne and Modesto's marriage ended just as it was throughout, turbulent. Marianne filed for legal separation shortly after Modesto escaped. And Modesto was violent with her throughout the entire marriage. He spoiled Andrew to pieces, but failed to provide an actual healthy environment for him to grow up in, because he was beating up Marianne every other day. He even accused Marianne of cheating him like multiple times throughout their marriage, because their oldest daughter Elena was actually blonde haired and blue eyed, and he refused to believe that Elena was his daughter, which she was. But can you imagine being one of the other siblings, seeing him absolutely spoil Andrew to death?
Save big on everything for your next staining project when you shop at Menards. Transform your home in one weekend with exterior stain and sealer from Dutch Boy. It provides one coat protection on decks, fences, siding, and outdoor furniture, and repels rain after just 4 hours of application. That means quicker results, saving you both time and money. Check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for more great deals happening this week. Save big money
at Menards. Drivers who switch and save with Progressive could save hundreds. With that kind of money, you could go big time on a fancy water bottle.
With ultra titanium alloy metal.
You're not sure why you need all that. I mean, it just holds water.
But you're getting it anyway. Because if you're hiking near an active volcano and you accidentally drop the bottle into molten lava, your water will still be icy cold. Switch to Progressive and you could save big time. For water bottles. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates, not available in all states. Potential savings will vary.
And he's kind of like even saying like, well, you're not even my daughter. Like, that's so... I can't imagine being raised in that kind of environment. But that's not to say that this was all on Modesto. Marianne had the same starry-eyed ideals about Andrew as well, perhaps being told by Modesto every single day, like, our son is a genius, he's amazing, he's going to grow up to be amazing. Marianne believed that, and she also like nurtured this in Andrew. And of course, any parent believes the more love, the more attention, the more nurture you can give to your child, the better. That can only be good, right? But there's a level, and they went above and beyond. Shortly after his father escaped to the Philippines, Andrew actually decides to go and visit his father, having fantasies of his father living this life of luxury over there. He's going to be really rich, he's going to be living in this like amazing house. He'd literally spent his whole life hearing his father brag about his home life back in the Philippines. But once Andrew actually reaches his father in the Philippines, he realises that he's kind of living in squalor. He has no money, no prospects whatsoever. And Andrew spends about a month over there before deciding like, you know what, I'm done, I'm going back home. Because like father, like son, Andrew was now a snob about the finer things in life and he couldn't live in squalor with his father. And this would be the last time that Modesto and Andrew ever actually see each other. But let's just rewind a little bit and take a closer look at Andrew's sort of childhood and teenage years, like from his point of view. So like you've already gathered, Andrew was incredibly, incredibly spoiled. He was told he was best, he was told he was amazing, he could do anything that he wanted to do. But almost frustratingly, he did actually have the personality and the brains to back this up. His IQ was calculated at 147, which literally classifies him as a genius. He could tell the most incredible stories, keeping you on the edge of your seat. And he could literally just entertain a whole room full of people and be completely at ease with it. But his stories were almost always embellished, full of half-truths and straight-up lies. He was a pathological liar, and I think most people around him did know this about him, but they didn't really care because he was so fun to be around. He was really charismatic, he was able to make conversation with pretty much anyone, he was always fun, the life and soul of the party. People enjoyed being around him, until they didn't. And perhaps that's what makes him such an interesting serial killer to look at, because he's so opposite from the usual loner, weirdo stereotype. He wasn't that childhood animal killer who just snapped one day and started killing people instead. He was moulded by his upbringing. Everything he became was a result of how he was raised. Of course, there may have been something else behind that as well, but there's no denying that being told that you're incredible every single day of your life, then growing up and realising that you're not, is going to have some sort of negative effect. Everything Andrew became was moulded by his childhood, by his teenage years. It was a combination of his upbringing, his family life, class, money problems, homophobia, everything. Andrew went to one of the most wealthy schools in the area and he was completely out of his depth. Even with his family at their wealthiest, it still wasn't anything on the kind of money that these people had. And he was like surrounded by some of the most genuinely wealthy people in the entire state. he had a lot of catching up to do to be able to fit in with his peers. So when he was at school, he kind of had to lie in order to fit in. And he became really, really good at lying. And Andrew also had this uncanny ability to be able to change his appearance, like almost at will. I mean, fashion and keeping face was hugely important to Andrew, as it is to a lot of people, me included. You always want to be at the top of your fashion game. You want people to look at you and think, like, she looks good. But Andrew had this kind of like chameleon-like Ted Bundy-esque way of changing his appearance. As I mentioned earlier, his ethnicity was a mixture of Filipino and Italian, and this really worked to his advantage because he was able to sort of switch between his identities at ease. I'm going to post a series of photos now of Andrew, and in many of them you wouldn't be able to tell this the same person, like, at all. According to Andrew, he had his first gay experience when he was 13 years old, and from that day on, he was very much out and proud to everyone at school. And I'm not talking just like out, he was like flamboyantly gay. He loved all of the attention that being gay got him, even if it was negative, because it meant people were talking about him. But this was the 80s, and a lot of people would have had a problem with this. But although he was openly gay and seemingly comfortable with it, a lot of people do suspect that homophobia, both his own internalized homophobia and other people's, may have been a big contributing factor as to why he ended up doing what he did. By the time Andrew left school, he was voted least likely to be forgotten by his classmates, which just seems a bit foreboding, and something that Andrew was very, very proud of. And you can't exactly say they were wrong, can you? In his yearbook, underneath his photo, he includes the quote, "Après moi déluge," which is a French phrase often attributed to King Louis XV. And it literally translates to, "After me, the flood." However, in historical context, it's actually more often interpreted as, "After me comes disaster." Again, it just seems a bit foreshadowing. It was after Andrew had left school and shortly after his father had left that his mother, his very devout Catholic mother, learned he was gay. Andrew was a frequenter of all the local gay clubs and restaurants in the area. He was very well known within the local gay community, but he wasn't actually out to his family, or to his mother at least, and he tells her when he's about 19, which I do find very interesting because he claims that he's so proud and out, and he's out to everyone, but he wasn't out to his own mother. So he must have had some level of shame, or he was scared that she wouldn't accept him. And that is kind of exactly what happened, because Mary was deeply religious, she'd raised the entire family Catholic, and she basically ends up having this huge argument with Andrew about the fact that he's gay. The argument ends when Andrew grabs his mother and throws her against a wall, dislocating her shoulder. And at this point, the authorities get involved. And looking back on police reports, a lot of people actually suspect that Andrew very much suffered with antisocial personality disorder, which is often characterized by a persistent disregard for morals, social norms, and the feelings of others. People with antisocial personality disorder often have no qualms in exploiting others to get what they want, and will frequently manipulate others through a facade of superficial charm and charisma. Sorry, I'm just reading like directly from the website here. This diagnosis will probably make more sense as we go throughout the video, but people think this is kind of like the first time that Andrew started to crack. It's worth noting as well that Andrew's father also refused to accept his homosexuality, saying after Andrew's death, sorry, spoiler, "My son is not like that. He is innocent. He is not a homosexual. He had a Catholic upbringing and was an altar boy. I don't believe he did what the American police say he did." I find it interesting that in the same sentence, in the same breath, he's denying that his son is a serial killer, but also denying that his son's gay. Like, you'd think that one would be more important than the other, but no, for Modesto, being gay is apparently just as bad as being a serial killer here. After graduating in 1987, Andrew enrolls at the University of California in San Diego, where he majors in American history. However, he drops out after 2 years and decides to move to San Francisco, where he settles in the Castro District, living with a wealthy friend. I talk about the San Francisco sort of Castro gay community a lot in my video that I did on the Doodler, which I'll link up here in a card and down below as well. So I don't want to like rehash it all again. It's not hugely vital information for this video, but it is an interesting little bit of context. So if you do want to go and watch that, then feel free. I just don't think there's any point in rehashing all of the same information that I've already given you. But Andrew becomes a fixture in the nightlife in the Castro District, And he has no job to speak of. He just lives with his wealthy friend and he befriends older men, letting them spoil him. He basically gets a whole load of sugar daddies, if we're talking about it in today's terms. Wealthy older men who had families of their own, having their fun with Andrew on the side and paying him to either stay away and like only come when he's like beckoned, or just for his company. Andrew was a gigolo. I don't know if gigolo is still like a term that's really widely used today. Maybe you could say he was more of an escort. Occasionally he'd be paid for sex, but a lot of the time it was just for company, because Andrew was, like I've mentioned, a good fun person to be around. He had no actual money to his name really, but he'd constantly show off about all of his wealth. He'd always be the one to pay for the round of drinks, or pay for dinner, or be the one to leave an obscenely huge tip. And he begins using the name Andrew De Silva around this time. It was more American, and he was actually worried that the name Kinanan would give away his ethnicity. And I don't think it was so much shame at being Filipino, maybe it was, but I think it was just part of his air of mystery. He didn't want anyone to truly know who he was. An FBI criminal profiler would later say Andrew's entire self-worth was tied to the finer things in life. Being accepted in high society and by wealthy people was what he expected. If he didn't get them, he was lost. And like I've said as well a couple of times, Andrew was a pathological liar. Most of the lies Andrew would tell around this time would sort of like center around his apparent connection to the rich and to the famous.
Save big on everything for your next staining project when you shop at Menards. Transform your home in one weekend with exterior stain and sealer from Dutch Boy. It provides one coat protection on decks, fences, siding, and outdoor furniture, and repels rain after just 4 hours of application. That means quicker results, saving you both time and money. Check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for more great deals happening this week. Save big money
at Menards. Drivers who switch and save with Progressive could save hundreds. With that kind of money, you could go big time on a fancy water bottle. With ultra titanium alloy metal. You're not sure why you need all that. I mean, it just holds water. But you're getting it anyway. Because if you're hiking near an active volcano and you accidentally drop the bottle into molten lava, your water will still be icy cold. Switch to Progressive and you could save big time. For water bottles. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and affiliates, not available in all states. Potential savings will vary.
The only time he would ever like admit to his Filipino roots was when he was either talking about how his father owned millions of pounds worth of pineapple plantations, or that his father was really good friends with Imelda Marcos. Or he would claim that his mum was best friends with Debbie Harry and had claimed to be Jewish when he was actually raised as Catholic. Just loads of silly little lies, but lies that would impress people. It's around this time in 1990 that Andrew reportedly meets Gianni Versace, although it's worth saying that the Versace family deny that Andrew and Gianni ever met at all. Gianni Versace was one of Andrew's absolute idols. Perhaps he saw himself in him. Gianni came from this small city in Italy. He was the son of a dressmaker. They weren't particularly poor, but they weren't particularly rich either. And Gianni had made himself this entire empire, the Versace empire, based purely on his talent and his business skills. And Gianni was openly gay. And Andrew, of course, had no particular talents, no way to build himself up. And he wasn't interested in actually building himself up through society in the correct way. He just wanted to have it, just be given it. Now, whilst Andrew was living in San Francisco, he kept company with a man called Eli Gold, who was a wealthy and very well-known lawyer at the time. Eli was given VIP passes one night to the gay club Colossus by his friend Val Canaparoli. Val was a choreographer who was working on the new opera in town, Capriccio. And who was doing the costumes on Capriccio? None other than Gianni Versace. And Gianni Versace was in town with Val acting as his guide. Now, Eli and Andrew are in Colossus that night when Versace walks in with his entourage, and Versace's introduced to a few people. Everyone is eager to meet him. Everyone really wants to meet Versace because he's Versace. Now, Andrew doesn't really say anything. He's just sort of standing there in the VIP area. And after about 15 minutes, Gianni apparently notices Andrew. And now this just comes from a few like eyewitness accounts. And Gianni starts to walk in their direction. He approaches Andrew and says, "I know you. Lago di Como, no?" Now Lake Como, I may have said that wrong, was actually where Gianni owned a house in Italy. Now either it was a case of mistaken identity, because Andrew had literally never been to Italy, or Versace just wanted to strike up conversation with him, because Andrew was a pretty good looking guy. He seemed interesting. Apparently this was a conversation starter that Gianni would use quite often if he wanted to like make conversation with somebody. He'd just start talking to them about Lake Como. I'm so sorry, I don't know how to pronounce that. And Andrew just replies straight up lying, saying, "That's right, thank you for remembering Signor Versace." And this kind of worked out for Andrew because Andrew had already been bragging to everyone he knew about how he knew Versace. There's rumours that the pair met again, but these are less substantiated. There's a potential story about Andrew being in a car with Versace one night. There's not really much to that, but I think they definitely met at least once. Now, eventually, the friends Andrew lived in San Francisco decided to move to Sacramento, and so Andrew has no choice but to move back to San Diego because he's got no actual money of his own. So he goes back to live with his mother, and it's at this point in his life that he starts to do crystal meth, something which was very prevalent in the gay community at the time. But he wasn't just taking the drugs, he was dealing the drugs as well. This is like one of his only incomes, along with being a gigolo, an escort, whatever you want to say. But something else important to note about Andrew Kinnanen is that he had a very extreme taste in sex. He was very into S&M, which stands for sadism and masochism. And S&M is fine, of course, between two consensual partners who pay attention to boundaries. You do you, you have fun. If you're into that, go for it. But Andrew would often reportedly take it too far. He was always a dominator, he was always in charge, always trying to like force other people to participate in his game. And it's likely that a lot of the older wealthy men that Andrew was being paid by were paying him for sex, for S&M. And S&M was very prevalent in gay culture again at the time, more so than in straight culture. And maybe it was kind of liberation. So it's not as crazy as it sounds for Andrew to be interested in this kind of stuff, but he always took it too far. It would go past the point of consensual to be like worrying. He would frequently go on wild sex and drug binges. He had a particular taste for whips and shackles. He liked to be in control. And he would very much spend the next few years of his life deep in this lifestyle. In 1994, he meets a 58-year-old man called Norman Blatchford, who was a retired millionaire, maybe even billionaire. Like, this guy had money. And Norman would pay for Andrew's entire lifestyle, letting him live in one of his two houses. Norman gave Andrew an allowance of $2,500 a month, which, considering he was living rent-free in one of his houses, was quite a lot of money. And you're probably wondering how Andrew was able to charm all of these men, particularly older men. And the answer is simple. He was smart, he was very bright, and he was very, very cultured. By the time Andrew was 10, apparently he'd read the entire set of encyclopedias in the Kinnanen household, and he could just talk about them for hours. Any fact in there, he remembered it. How cultured he was wasn't just a facade Andrew put on, like, this was genuine. He could talk to the top people in their field about art, literature, politics, literally anything. Andrew meets the man who would go on to become his first victim, Jeff Trail, in late 1992, early 93. Jeff was in the Navy and he was docked in San Diego at the time. Now, Jeff knew he was gay, but he was in the military, who forbade homosexual people from serving. So he kind of had no choice but to be very, very quiet about the fact he was gay. So when Jeff happens to meet Andrew one day, he's in absolute awe of how comfortable Andrew seems to be in himself. He's so open about his sexuality, so unapologetic for it. And that was something that Jeff could only dream of being. So Jeff begins to hang around with Andrew and starts to run in the same social circles, going to all of the same high-class parties as Andrew. But it seems that Andrew was a little bit ashamed of Jeff. He wasn't quite high society enough for him. At his own 26th birthday party, Andrew buys a pair of Ferragamo shoes, which was another big designer in the 90s, and gives them to Jeff to give back to him, pretending that he'd bought him this really expensive pair of shoes. And Andrew also bought a pair of these shoes for himself, and he actually asked Jeff to pretend to be a doctor for the evening. Like, he just wanted Jeff to seem more than he was. But it seems their relationship wasn't a sexual one, like, they never had any form of sexual relationship whatsoever. And Andrew would frequently set Jeff up with other people, so it wasn't like that. Andrew definitely admired Jeff though, even though he wasn't quite like high society enough for him. Andrew would copy how Jeff would shave, how he'd cut his hair. If Jeff bought a top, Andrew would buy the same top. And it's important to note as well that people generally didn't like Andrew. Everyone knew he was weird. Like, people just thought Andrew's a little bit strange, but they kept him around because he was good fun to be around. It doesn't mean they liked who he was. He told good stories. He was never harmful, just a bit of a fantasist. And Jeff would apparently say to friends, it's like having a black sheep in your family. You just kind of put up with him and you love him. And then in 1995, Andrew meets architect David Madsen in a San Francisco bar, and he's immediately attracted to David and sends him over a drink, and the two start talking. David was described by people as being charismatic and an absolute joy to be around. And apparently the two of them, Andrew and David, had an instant spark and they begin dating. Andrew was apparently dazzled by the expensive life David would live as an architect. He had money. And David lived in San Francisco in a really nice apartment. He had a really nice car. He had a dog called Prince, who was just like the love of his life. And whilst Prince was David's love of his life, apparently David was Andrew's. Andrew would frequently tell people that David was the love of his life. But it seems like these feelings weren't particularly reciprocated. David just kind of moved on from Andrew pretty quickly. By September 1996, their relationship ends and David moves back to Minneapolis. And then in November 1996, in a pure stroke of coincidence, Jeff Trail also moves to Minneapolis for a new job. Now, David and Jeff didn't know each other at all before moving to the city, but they became sort of like casual acquaintances, maybe you could say friends, after finding out they both knew Andrew back home.
What if I told you that right now, millions of people are living with a debilitating condition that's so misunderstood, many of them don't even know that they have it? That condition is obsessive compulsive disorder, or OCD. I'm Dr. Patrick McGrath, the Chief Clinical Officer of NOCD. And in the 25 years I've been treating OCD, I've met so many people who were suffering from the condition in silence, unaware of just what it was. OCD can create overwhelming anxiety and fear around what you value most, make you question your identity, beliefs, and morals, and drive you to perform mentally and physically draining compulsions or rituals. Over my career, I've seen just how devastating OCD can be when it's left untreated. But help is available. That's where NOCD comes in. NOCD is the world's largest virtual therapy provider for obsessive compulsive disorder. Our licensed therapists are trained in exposure and response prevention therapy, a specialized treatment proven to be incredibly effective for OCD. So visit NOCD.com to schedule a free 15-minute call with our team. That's NOCD.com.
Hey, Mama, you don't have time to be messing around endlessly scrolling to find a caregiver for your child. Let me clue you in to my trick to save time and my sanity when finding a sitter. SitterCity.com. SitterCity knows what they're doing. They've been helping busy parents find the perfect sitter for over 20 years. While other sites overwhelm you by throwing hundreds of random profiles your way, SitterCity matches you with caregivers who actually fit your needs. No endless scrolling, no guesswork. I love that all caregivers undergo ID verification. They have background checks, specialized qualifications, and real parent reviews to know if they showed up on time or really know how to handle my sassy toddler. And if I need help, I can talk to a real live human, not a robot, with SitterCity's delightful team. You know, my employer pays for me to get SitterCity completely free as part of my benefits. Yours could too. SitterCity is my go-to for a smarter, simpler way to find reliable, trustworthy care. Don't wait. Go to SitterCity.com/XX and get the help you need.
Now, the assassination of Gianni Versace depicts the two of them being in a romantic relationship, but a lot of creative liberty was taken here. Jeff and David were not in any kind of romantic relationship at all, at least that anyone knew about. Apparently, Jeff did give David a warning though, saying, "You can't believe a word Andrew says. He'll say anything to get a reaction." Jeff had gotten sick of Andrew months before his move to Minneapolis. He was bored of his erratic behaviour, bored of his constant showing off, and he just didn't feel comfortable around him. That was the problem with Andrew. He was fun for a little bit, but he was just a lot. And apparently Andrew had actually tried to get Jeff involved in his drug business as well, and Jeff wanted nothing to do with it. He was this upstanding military man, and apparently Andrew just wouldn't really leave him alone about it. So it was just a stroke of luck when Jeff got the offer to move to Minneapolis. But Andrew made a habit of showing up in Minneapolis unannounced and imposing on his friends' hospitality. He would literally just show up and either go to stay with either David or Jeff. And by this point, Jeff was just completely done with him. He was over it. And David was also seeing other people. He was no longer romantically interested in Andrew in any way whatsoever. Neither particularly wanted him there, but it's rude to be like, no, go away. So they'd just entertain him. Even though there wasn't anything ongoing between Jeff and David, we don't know if Andrew actually knew this. It's very likely that Andrew thought there was, as though he'd turn up to just go and check on the two. He described Jeff and David as being the two people he loved most in the entire world. Now, in late April 1997, Andrew tells his friends that he's leaving San Diego and that he needs to go to Minneapolis to settle some business. Now, on April 24th, Andrew organises a going away party for himself with four friends at Hillcrest California Cuisine. And this going away party lasts for 3 hours. And it was a very rare occasion where Andrew didn't cover the tab himself, perhaps showing that he was completely out of money by this point. On the 25th, he takes a one-way flight to Minnesota and he visits David first, who picks him up from the airport. The two go for dinner with some of David's other friends and they say that David was just incredibly uneasy all night. And then after this, they go clubbing, they go dancing. The next night was Saturday, and he actually spends Saturday at Jeff's apartment, even though Jeff was actually out of town with the partner at the time. I mean, Jeff was so done with Andrew at this point that he won't even like be in the apartment when he's staying there. At some point on the Sunday, Andrew returns to David's apartment and calls Jeff and asks him to come over that night so the three can hang out together. Now, it's not 100% known whether Andrew had pre-planned what he was going to do that night, but it's very likely he did. This was all organised. At the time that all of this was happening, it was the height of the AIDS crisis in America, which again, I cover in more detail in my Doodler video, so if you want to go watch that, that's some important context. Now, Andrew was once reported as saying, if I ever get HIV, I'll go on a 5-state killing spree. Now, whilst an autopsy after his death confirmed that Andrew did not have HIV, it's widely believed that Andrew thought he'd contacted the virus. At the end of the day, once again, it doesn't matter what the reality really is. All that matters is what Andrew thought was happening. A San Diego AIDS counsellor came forward and said that Andrew had actually approached him and started to ask all of these different questions about AIDS, and apparently he blurted out at one point, if I ever find out who did this to me, I'm going to get them. Is it possible that Andrew thought David, or maybe even Jeff, had given him HIV? Exactly what happened that night in David's apartment, we'll never know. Everyone who was there is dead. Jeff reached David's apartment about 9:45 p.m. that night on April 27th, 1977. Now, neighbours can hear some weird things going on in the apartment. Andrew spotted in the lift at one point. Apparently, an argument broke out with neighbours hearing loud noises and shouting, specifically, get the fuck out, and the sound of a wall being hit, and then they hear running water. And that's it, it goes quiet. Until Tuesday, when two of David's colleagues turn up at his apartment because he's failed to show up for work 2 days in a row. They reach the door and knock, but there's no answer, but they can hear noises inside. They think they can hear whispering. They call the police, and the police say that they can't break down the door because if they break down the door and David's dog Prince starts to like get all agitated and aggressive, then they're gonna have to shoot him, and they say it's not really worth the risk. And so David's colleagues have to get hold of the superintendent, who eventually let them in. They discover the apartment empty, no one's in there, apart from a body wrapped in a rug. At first, the authorities assume that it's David's body, I mean, it is his apartment after all. But by Wednesday morning, it's been identified as Jeff Trail, thanks to a tattoo on his left leg. The body was left in a brutal condition. Jeff had been beaten to death with a hammer, but not the hammer side, the claw side of the hammer, and he was hit with this claw over 25 times. His watch had been broken at some point in the struggle at 9:55 p.m, suggesting that this is most likely the time he died. He'd only arrived 10 minutes earlier. There was a wealth of different evidence in the apartment, including the murder weapon and a gym bag which contained drugs, porn, and bullets. Now, they apparently knew of Andrew visiting David that weekend, but they couldn't decide who this gym bag belonged to until one of David's friends like pointed out and said Andrew's name is literally on the bag. In all honesty, this case is filled with police mistakes, kind of beginning to end. But still, the gym bag didn't really help them decide who had done this, David or Andrew. All they knew is that Jeff was dead and Andrew and David were nowhere to be found. On the 28th, the day after Jeff would have died, apparently neighbours saw David and Andrew just walking the dog in the streets, like nothing had happened whatsoever. And this seems to be something people come back to a lot in this case. They think, well, if David knew that Andrew had killed Jeff, why was David just happily walking the dog with Andrew? It's obvious that for a time after Jeff died, David spent time with Andrew, and it doesn't seem like he made any particular effort to escape or go and get help. It's likely that Andrew had taken him as hostage and made threats to ensure that he didn't go running to the police. But it's also likely that institutionalised homophobia played a part in this as well, because David was currently a gay man in the 80s in the Midwest. And there's a very good chance that he knew that if he was to go to police and sort of say what was going on, they probably wouldn't believe him. They wouldn't take it seriously. Or if they did take it seriously, they'd go to his apartment and find Jeff dead, and he'd be the one to get the blame. Perhaps that sounds a little bit far-fetched for some of you watching, but you've got to understand what it was like at the time, and this was something that happened very, very often. As far as the police were concerned, gay men were kind of the bottom of the food chain. On the Wednesday, April 30th, David's red Jeep Cherokee is seen parked at a Chicago parking garage from 6 a.m. until 7 p.m. And then David's body is found by fishermen on the east shore of Rush Lake in Rush City, Minnesota on May 3rd. Now, David had been shot 3 times with a gun taken from Jeff's home with 40 caliber bullets. He was shot each once in the face, back of the head, and back. David's official date of death was put down as the 2nd of May, but seeing as Andrew was likely already in Chicago by the 30th of April, there's a chance that David may have been dead before that. But by the 3rd of May, Andrew was getting ready for his next kill, a man called Lee Miglin. 72-year-old Lee Miglin was an impressive businessman. He had over 50 years working in real estate, and he was incredibly, incredibly wealthy. And he was really well liked by pretty much everyone who knew him, who said he was kind, brilliant, generous, and really humble. To this day, the Miglin family denied that there was any previous connection between Andrew Kinnunen and Lee Miglin, insisting that it was just a completely random attack, a robbery. Maybe Andrew knew of Lee's wealth. I mean, people knew of Lee's wealth. But a lot of people actually think they did know each other, that Lee was one of Andrew's wealthy sugar daddies. And of course, no one would know about this if it was true, because it's not likely that Lee would go around bragging about it. I'm a little bit torn on this. Part of me thinks that they did know each other, part of me thinks they didn't. I don't think it's any coincidence that Andrew would just happen to drive to Chicago out of anywhere in the country and just happened to go to Lee Miglin's house when his wife Marilyn just happens to be out of town on a business trip. I mean, it's speculated that Lee contacted Andrew and told him to come around because his wife was away. Or other people speculate that the link wasn't between Andrew and Lee at all, it was actually between Andrew and Lee's son, Duke, instead. Apparently Andrew bragged about working on movie sets, and Duke worked on movie sets. Apparently he also used to brag about knowing a wealthy family in Chicago and that he would go and spend weekends with them. It's not crazy to think that the Miglin family could have been this family. There's no sign of forced entry into Lee's house, which suggested that either Andrew accosted Lee whilst they were still outside with a gun, or that Lee let him in because he knew him. But what we do know is that Lee met his death in the garage, and his death was a very brutal one. His neck was slashed multiple times, almost completely beheading him, as well as being stabbed in the chest multiple times with a screwdriver as well, 2 of the stab wounds penetrating his heart. He had multiple injuries to his head, which was completely covered with duct tape, leaving only small holes for his nostrils and his mouth. Andrew then grabs 2 bags of cement, really, really heavy bags of cement, and throws them down on top of Lee's body, fracturing every single one of his ribs. And this would have been done after Lee's death. He was already dead at this point, so why would Andrew feel the need to do this? It's just pure violence for the sake of violence. He then covers the body with plastic and brown wrapping paper before heading back up into the house. He's in absolutely no hurry to escape whatsoever. He sleeps in Lee's bed, he uses their bathroom, he has a bath, he shaves, and just generally makes a bit of a mess.
Save big on everything for your next staining project when you shop at Menards. Transform your home in 1 weekend with exterior stain and sealer from Dutch Boy. It provides 1 coat protection on decks, fences, siding, and outdoor furniture, and repels rain after just 4 hours of application. That means quicker results, saving you both time and money. Check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for more great deals happening this week. Save big money
at Menards. Drivers who switch and save with Progressive could save hundreds. With that kind of money, you could go big time on a fancy water bottle with ultra titanium alloy metal. You're not sure why you need all that. I mean, it just holds water. But you're getting it anyway. Because if you're hiking near an active volcano and you accidentally drop the bottle into molten lava, your water will still be icy cold. Switch to Progressive and you could save big time. For water bottles. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and affiliates, not available in all states. Potential savings will vary.
He eats, he leaves ice cream on the side in the kitchen. He's just completely calm, and so apparently is the family dog as well, Honey, who showed no signs whatsoever of being scared of this weird intruder in the house. And once Andrew had sorted himself out, he steals Lee's car and he starts to drive after stealing $2,000 from the house and gold coins, amongst other things. Marilyn, Lee's wife, arrives home from her business trip on Sunday morning. Now, Lee was supposed to pick her up from the airport, but he never showed. And this was very, very unlike him. So she was already feeling a little bit easy as she got a taxi home from the airport. As soon as she walks into the home, she can immediately tell that something is wrong because Lee was very, very tidy person, maybe too tidy. He was one of those kinds of people, everything had its place and everything was always in its place. But the house was a mess. There was the uneaten ice cream lying on the side in the kitchen. There was ham on Lee's desk. And Marilyn immediately knows that something's up. She'd been married to Lee for 38 years. And she knows that he's dead. She goes out the front of the house and asks for her neighbour's help. And she calls the police. At first, the police don't find Lee's body anywhere in the home. And they start an investigation before eventually somebody spots him hidden under the plastic and the brown paper. At first, the police think there are actually multiple killers involved in this because of all the disarray in the house, but it doesn't take them long to link back to the murders that happened in Minneapolis, and Andrew Kananen becomes their prime suspect. Following this murder, he actually becomes the 449th fugitive to be listed in the FBI's 10 most wanted list. And I have no doubt that Andrew would have known this, and he would have loved being on the FBI's most wanted, because finally, people knew his name. He was doing something with himself. Andrew heads east in Lee's 1994 Lexus, eventually arriving in Lower Manhattan. He spends 4 days in New York. He buys a pair of jeans from the Levi's store. He goes to a $15 a day bathhouse where he just chills. He relaxes at this bathhouse until eventually he gets back in his car and continues to drive south. He's just driving along the interstates, listening to the radio, probably trying to hear what the police have to say about these murders, about him. And he actually hears on the radio that the police are tracking him through the car's cell phone. Now, this was one of those old style cars which actually had a cell phone in the car, and Andrew had actually been trying to make several calls from this, clearly not realizing that he could be tracked. And so he hears this on the radio, somehow this information's leaked out from the police, and he immediately snaps the antenna off the car and decides that he needs another vehicle. Which leads to his next murder. Andrew drives into New Jersey, where he follows the signs for Fort Mott State Park, looking for a secluded area to ditch the car. He comes across Finns Point National Cemetery in the same complex as the national park, and he comes across 45-year-old William Reese. Now, this cemetery wasn't just a regular cemetery, it was actually holding bodies from the Civil War. So it's not like there were loads of people around grieving for their loved ones. These bodies were over 100 years old, at least. And William worked at this cemetery. He was a Civil War buff. It was the perfect job for him. He was the caretaker there. And Andrew confronts William in the car park and leads him down to the basement of the building there. And basically, William most likely happily handed over the keys to his car. William didn't really like confrontation. He wouldn't have wanted to give up his life for his car. So it's very likely that he would just happily handed over the keys. But Andrew leads him down to the basement and shoots him execution style, which was a completely needless death. This was a family man. He had a family. He never caused any harm to anyone. And Andrew just killed him just because. Andrew takes William's red pickup truck and drives it down south, stopping in South Carolina to steal some license plates off another car, which he then places on this car. So now nobody can track him. By this point, Andrew Kananen is a national story. The FBI are trying to track him down with all of the latest technology, but after New Jersey, they have no track of him whatsoever. They've completely lost him. The FBI actually use a computer program called Rapid Start to track him, which basically allows them to collate all these thousands of little pieces of information, even the smallest tips from the public. It all goes into this computer program and basically turns them into like bigger tips. But whilst the FBI used all these sophisticated computer programs, the most police departments in the country were still using traditional paper filing systems. When Andrew arrives in Miami, he actually checks into the Normandy Plaza Hotel, paying $36 a night with all of the remaining $2,000 he stole from Lee Miglin. He uses a fake name and a fake passport, and he actually gets one of the nicest rooms in the place, going on to live there for over 2 months undetected. But although he was undetected, it doesn't mean by any means that he lived quietly. He became a very common face on the Miami Beach gay scene. He was going out clubbing, he was going to restaurants, like he wasn't living quietly by any means. But it's not hugely shocking that Andrew wasn't found down there. South Florida is reportedly one of the best places to go in the USA if you want to basically run away, go undetected, because there's a constantly shifting population, transients, tourists, people constantly moving in and out of this place. And so nobody really pays much attention to anybody. And Andrew's chameleon-like appearance probably would have lent to this as well. And the fact that he was Filipino, meaning that he had very Latino-like skin. And considering that South Florida has a very high Latino population, he would have blended right in. But the fact that people didn't really pay attention to people down in Miami Beach is also kind of the reason why Gianni Versace chose it to be his home. Although Gianni was this massive celebrity, he felt like he could live a relatively normal life in Miami Beach because just nobody really paid attention to him down there. At one point, whilst Andrew is living in the hotel, he clearly is beginning to run out of money because he goes to a nearby pawn shop and he actually tries to pawn a gold coin that he stole from Lee Miglin's house. And this is the Cash on the Beach pawn shop in Miami Beach. So Andrew goes in, and basically when you pawn anything in Florida, you have to give your name, you have to give a fingerprint, because basically the pawn shop needs to send all of this paperwork to the police to ensure that the items that they're being sold aren't stolen. So that's what Andrew does. He goes in, he gives his fingerprint, he gives his real name, this time he gives his real passport, and that's that. He gets the money, and the pawn shop owner does hand this paperwork over to the police as they're supposed to, but because, like I said, everything was paper at the time, it literally just gets lost in the shuffle and nobody picks up on the fact that Andrew Kananen is in South Florida. Now, Andrew's actually recognised just once whilst he's down in Miami. Somebody recognises him from America's Most Wanted, a TV show that was on, I think, the previous week. And this person recognises him and actually goes and immediately calls the police, and they're trying to like keep Andrew in the shop, keep him like busy, but Andrew actually ends up leaving and they can't exactly grab him. So Andrew walks out and just 3 minutes later the police arrive and they've missed him. Now I'm about to talk about the murder of Gianni Versace, but before I do so, I just want to give you a short history on Versace. He was an Italian fashion designer, arguably one of the best in the entire world. I personally love anything Versace still to this day. He was born in the city of Reggio Calabria in Italy on the 2nd of December 1946, and he grew up with his older brother Santo and his younger sister Donatella, a name you probably recognise. He also had another older sister called Tina as well, but Tina sadly died when she was 12 years old from complications from a tetanus infection. Gianni's mother, Francesca, was actually a dressmaker herself, so fashion was something that Gianni grew up with from a very young age. It seemed to be in his blood, and he actually began doing an apprenticeship with his mother when he was pretty young, and he was very talented, and this was something his mother really nurtured in him. At the age of 26, he actually moves to Milan to work, and he slowly built his way through the fashion industry, and he actually holds his very first Versace fashion show in September 1977, opening his first boutique a year later in 78. Versace quickly becomes a sensation on the international fashion scene. He is the name of the moment, because you just couldn't ignore his designs. They were so different from everything else that was out there. He used bold colours, bold prints, with very, very sexy cuts. He believed that clothes were meant to be sexy. They were meant to enhance a woman's body and not cover it up. And his fashion was controversial, but people paid attention to him. He wasn't afraid to do what the other designers wouldn't, and he would always say that Donatella was his biggest muse. He didn't just stop at high fashion though, because he was also a very prolific costume designer as well. He was a huge fan of the theatre, saying that it was a liberation. And he was actually working on an opera that it's likely that Andrew and Gianni first crossed paths. And Gianni also obviously was openly gay, never giving any apologies for being the way that he was. He met his partner Antonio D'Amico in 1982, and their relationship would actually last for 15 years until the day that Gianni died. Gianni and Antonio were big names on the Miami gay scene. Everyone knew them. They would regularly make all these appearances at clubs with all their entourage, and it's very likely that Andrew saw Gianni out at some of these clubs in Miami. In the 2 years before the murder, Gianni had actually had a lot of health problems. He'd been battling with with a very rare form of cancer in his ear, and it was very expected that he was going to die. It was impossible to do surgery on it because it was in a really awkward place. And so Gianni got all of his ducks in a row. He wrote his will, he told his family what he expected of them after his death. He was going to leave his 45% share in Versace to his niece Allegra, Donatella's daughter.
Save big on everything for your next staining project when you shop at Menards. Transform your home in one weekend with exterior stain and sealer from Dutch Boy. It provides one coat protection on decks, fences, siding, and outdoor furniture, and repels rain after just 4 hours of application. That means quicker results, saving you both time and money. Check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for more great deals happening this week. Save big money
at Menards. Drivers who switch and save with Progressive could save hundreds. With that kind of money, you could go big time on a fancy water bottle with ultra-titanium alloy metal. You're not sure why you need all that. I mean, it just holds water. But you're getting it anyway. Because if you're hiking near an active volcano and you accidentally drop the bottle into molten lava, your water will still be icy cold. Switch to Progressive and you could save big time. For water bottles. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and affiliates, not available in all states. Potential savings will vary.
And Donatella was to become the new head of design. Santo was to become the new CEO of Versace. So Gianni just had everything in a row, and he was going to leave Antonio with a lifelong pension of 50 million lira, which is about 25,000 euros a month, and the right to live in any of his homes across the US and Italy. This is what Gianni expected to happen. And sadly, actually, after he did die, the family wouldn't actually let Antonio have really any of it. He just got a fraction of what Gianni promised him. But somehow, just 6 months before he was eventually murdered, Gianni was declared cured of his cancer, which made his death on the 15th of July in 1997 that much sadder. He was just 50 years old and he'd just recovered from cancer. He thought he had now a whole life ahead of him, and it was taken away. Gianni lived in an oceanfront mansion in Miami Beach. He'd lived there since 1992 after he'd fallen in love with Miami. Now, exactly why Andrew Cananan chose Gianni Versace as his final victim, we'll never really know for sure. People who knew Andrew said that he was obsessed with Versace and had been for years. Maybe Andrew wanted to be famous and this was the only way he knew how. Maybe it was personally symbolic. Maybe the wealthy, high-profile gay man is everything Andrew wanted to be, but never was. But that is what Versace was. The morning of his death, Gianni had gone for a walk to a nearby cafe to buy magazines, which is a trip he made pretty often. People generally wouldn't bother him, and that's the reason he liked Miami Beach. He could live his life, and that was that. Gianni was walking up the steps of his mansion to the gate, where he put his key in the gate ready to open it, when Andrew Cananan comes up behind him and shoots him twice at point blank range. He shoots him once in the side of the face and once below his ear. Then Andrew turns around and walks away. But bear in mind, this was like 9 a.m, pure daylight. There were people around, witnesses, people who saw exactly what happened. There was actually a woman in the street who witnessed the entire thing. Drawn in by the gunshots, people started to gather around. Somebody called 911 to get help for Versace, but so many people turned up wanting to get pictures. One guy even like ran home to get his Polaroid to get a photo of Gianni Versace lying dead on the steps of his mansion, and the guy actually tried to sell this for $30,000. Somebody did try to pursue Andrew as he ran away, but they couldn't catch up to him, but luckily somebody saw him run into a nearby parking garage. The police were quick to arrive, finding Gianni lying on the steps, and they actually found a dead white dove lying next to him. Now, as Andrew had made the shots at Gianni, a part of one of the bullets had ricocheted off and hit a white dove that was actually resting nearby. There's something very symbolic about this. Gianni Versace, one of the best fashion designers probably of all time, being found dead, lying next to a white dove. Now, the name Andrew Cananan wasn't one that crossed the police's minds at first, because they thought it was actually a mafia hit. The white dove lying next to Gianni was surely a sign of the mafia, because they'd often do that, they'd leave dead birds near their hips. But it turns out it was just a pure coincidence. But it didn't take them long to make the link back to Andrew, because they actually found the car, William Reese's stolen car, in the parking garage where somebody had seen him run. Inside the car, they found Andrew's clothes, they found a passport, and they found clipped newspaper reports of all of Andrew's previous murders. Versace's funeral took place on July 22nd, 1997. Over 2,000 people were in attendance, including some of the biggest celebrities of the time. Anna Wintour, Karl Lagerfeld, Naomi Campbell, Elton John, Sting, even Princess Diana. It was held in a 14th century chapel in Milan. It was huge, and I'm sure Andrew was following on the news, wishing that his funeral could be anything like that one. Whilst the police had fell short of finding Andrew after his previous four murders, this was a full-on manhunt now. Versace's death was huge and they just had to find him. There's police roaming the streets, there's helicopters, dogs, there were checkpoints on every single route out of the city. There was literally no way for Andrew Cunanan to escape at this point. And on July 23rd, 1997, the manhunt finally ends when the police get a tip-off and surround a houseboat docked at 5250 Collins Avenue in Miami. There's a 5-hour standoff with the police trying to get Andrew off the boat, and honestly I couldn't find out if Andrew was alive for any of this time. But when they eventually board the boat after 5 hours, Andrew is lying dead on the bed, having shot himself through the mouth with a gun. There's a press conference with the police chief saying, "All across the nation, our citizens can stand down and breathe a sigh of relief. The reign of terror brought upon us by Andrew Cunanan is over." So there was never a trial. We were never able to find out why Andrew did what he did. We were never able to get a diagnosis for him. There's strong theories, obviously, that he did have antisocial personality disorder. A lot of people think that he most definitely had this, maybe amongst other things as well, but we'll never really know for certain. A lot of people suspect that if the police had been more willing to work with the gay community at this time, then Versace's death probably could have been avoided. I mean, Andrew was an out and proud gay man, they knew this. If they'd gone to any gay community and asked, like, where are the best places to be, they probably would have said either San Francisco or Miami Beach. And the police never did this, they never bothered to find out. But if they had gone down to Miami Beach and just asked a few people in the gay community down there, they probably would have said straight out that, yep, Andrew's been wandering around. I don't know that much could have been done to prevent the deaths of Jeff and David. They were going to happen regardless, but especially the deaths of William Reese and Gianni Versace, they could have been avoided. Growing up, Andrew was never taught the importance of values and morals. He was taught the most important thing was to be wealthy and to be in high society, and this messed him up. No child who is raised from the day he is born being told that he is the best person in the entire world is going to grow up to be a healthy-minded adult. Thank you so much for tuning into this week's episode of Mysteries and Histories. If you have a bit of time, I would love for you to go and leave a review wherever you're listening to this podcast and spread the word. It would be much appreciated. I'll see you next week.
Save big on everything for your next staining project when you shop at Menards. Transform your home in one weekend with exterior stain and sealer from Dutch Boy. It provides one coat protection on decks, fences, siding, and outdoor furniture, and repels rain after just 4 hours of application. That means quicker results, saving you both time and money. Check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for more great deals happening this week. Save big money at Menards. Open the door to huge savings now at Menards. Enhance the appearance of your home with a new stylish garage door. Choose from our large in-stock selection of ideal garage doors or design your own using our free garage door designer in-store or on Menards.com. Save big and ideal garage doors. And don't forget to check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now. Save